Isaiah chapter 2. Think of the reading in verse 1. And the word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and that came to pass in the latter days, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. And if you recall, in this section, we have what is going to take place in the latter days, and we see this great ministry. And so I wanted to spend some time dealing with the idea that in the latter day ministry, and that time period starts at Christ's first coming and goes all the way until he returns. And this latter days, based on the testimony of the New Testament, is the messianic era. And so when the prophets talk about these things that would take place in the latter days, that's what they're looking for. They're looking forward to the messianic period. And so in the New Testament, this is why you would read, God has spoken to us in times past in diverse manners through the prophets, but in these last days has spoken to us by his Son. So we see the last days was something that they were familiar with. The prophets were pointing to that, and that took place during this messianic age. And what's interesting is we see that during these latter days, the ministry of the church, one of the things that they would do is bring forth in the teaching of the law. And so we've been looking at that over the last couple of weeks, what I'm calling the latter day ministry. And this is important. So turn with me to Romans chapter 3. I want to continue to look at, Paul gives us an example here of a lawful use of the law. Certainly there are ways to misuse the law and to teach it in such a way that God did not intend. And, you know, legalism and works-based righteousness would be an example of that. Well, we're not promoting that. What we are saying is that there is a lawful use of the law. And, you know, Paul and the other apostles, when they talk about the law, they're teaching us how to use it lawfully. I want to use Romans 3:19 as a basis of a lawful use of the law. In Romans 3:19, we read, Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. And if you think about what's going on in the modern church today, we need to be reminded of this because, you know, I don't know if any of you guys remember Robert Schuller, one of the liberal heretics that's out there that's kind of was popular back in the 80s and 90s, and he has an influence and impact on what you see going on today. But back then he wrote a book called Self-Esteem, The New Reformation. And this is what he wrote. What we need is a salvation that begins and ends with the recognition for every person's hunger for glory. I want you to stop and think about that. This is a man who claims to be a minister of the gospel, and you're all kind of looking puzzled like, that makes no sense in light of what the Scriptures teach us. Is that what the gospel would say? We need to start with a gospel that recognizes every person's hunger for glory. And he defines sin as any act that robs myself or another human being of his or her self-esteem. So when you see these churches that really push this self-esteem, we don't want to offend anybody, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know, the idea of not hurting anyone's self-esteem, well, this is kind of where it comes from. The question then becomes, how should we then present the gospel? Well, this is his answer. The gospel message is not found only faulty but potentially dangerous if it has to put a person down before it attempts to pick him up. One should be exalted. One should never be abased. And so in contrast with, you know, Mr. Schuller's heretical statements, the Apostle Paul comes to us and he gives us verses 19 and 20. Paul takes a totally different approach to sharing salvation than Mr. Schuller does. Instead of making one feel good about himself, Paul shows us what we really are before God's holy law. And Paul would argue that one cannot be saved until he sees himself as they are and turn from themselves to Christ for salvation. And so I don't too much concern myself with the gospel according to Robert Schuller, but or any of the other liberals that are out there, but I want to know what Paul and the other apostles have to say concerning Jesus Christ about salvation. And it's interesting, they bring the law to the equation. Now, what I mean by that is they are using the law to drive the sinner to Christ. That's a lawful use of the law. So Paul says, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Pascal said this, man is great in as so far as he realizes that he is wretched. I mean, when we come to recognize that we are wretched before a holy God, now we're prepared to go to the Savior. C.S. Lewis said it this way, we are not just imperfect people who need to grow, we are rebels who need to lay down our arms. Malcolm Muldridge said this, human depravity is at once the most empirically verifiable reality, but also the most philosophically resistant. And so this is Paul's conclusion in chapter 3 of Romans. If you remember our study of Romans, Paul has just argued up into verse 19 the universal sinfulness of all mankind, both Jews and Gentiles. And so based on his argumentation, then we'd have to ask the question, what is the greatest need of mankind? Is it to make men better? Is it to make men good? And the answer is no. The greatest need of every man is to recognize his need for salvation. Every man needs to understand that he stands condemned before this holy God. And so his greatest need is to be made right with God. He needs a righteousness that God requires. And he needs to understand that he stands condemned before God because he is unrighteous. And so this is the context we find ourselves in when we come to Romans 3, 19 and 20. And so I want us to look at the grammar here. The grammar will help us understand Paul's flow of thought. So remember, Paul is on the other side of the cross. Paul's on the other side of the resurrection and the ascension of Christ. He's in the latter-day ministry, and he's preaching. And what is he preaching? He's teaching us something about the law, and he's showing us a lawful use of the law. And so we can learn from him and follow in his footsteps. Now, we know, Paul says. Look at verse 19. Now we know. The question is, well, what do we know? Know what? He says, we know that, and that's your content. We know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world might be answerable to God. And so, Paul, why is all of this true? Well, we see it in verse 20. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. And so, the King James Version translates the beginning of verse 20 as therefore. However, I believe this is causal, not a result. And so I'm going to translate because, not therefore. So I would translate because by the deeds of the law no flesh will be justified in his sight. For, and here's his explanation, the law is the knowledge of sin. And so these connective words help me understand what Paul is trying to say here. So we understand something of the grammar. But what do these terms mean? You know, we understand the flow of thought, we understand the grammar, but what do the terms mean? So let's look at them. What does this word know? So when I come back to verse 19, now we know. Well, what does the word know mean? The word used here is the word for objective knowledge. It is intellectual knowledge. It's something that is not subjective. It's something that you can know intellectually. So when Paul says, now we know, this means this is something I can know cognitively. I can know this objectively. So we know objectively that whatsoever the law is saying, and immediately I'm confronted with this word law, and we have to ask the question, well, what is this word law? What does it mean? It comes from the Greek word nomos. And so it's important for us to understand because Paul uses this word several times within these two verses. And so when I read these verses, he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. So over and over again, this idea of the law. Now, in order for us to understand what it means, we need to answer this question. We need to understand what this phrase, under the law, refers to. Who does this refer to? Now, the commentators will argue over this question. Some take the position that it only refers to the Jews, since the Jews are under the law. With this position, you're assuming that Paul is referring only to the Mosaic law. However, the problem I have with that view is the context of Romans 19, 3 and 20. Romans 3, 19 and 20. If you look at the context, Paul has just quoted from many Old Testament passages, and even though the Old Testament was given to the Jews, the multiple references it that he refers to the Gentiles in the Old Testament. So this tells me the whole world was in mind when Paul wrote this. And if you continue to look further into verse 19, it talks about every mouth may be shut, not just Jewish mouths. And the whole world, he says in verse 20, may become guilty before God. And so I believe what Paul has here is when we ask the question, who is under the law? Everybody. Everyone's under law because every mouth will be shut and the whole world will become guilty before God. Now remember, he's just argued that all men stand condemned, both Jew and Gentiles, in verses 9 through 18, and he's summarizing that with this statement in verses 19 and 20. And remember, Paul argued that Gentiles stood condemned on what basis? Well, in chapter 2, he stated the Gentiles violate the law that was written on their heart. So on the basis, the Jews had violated the codified law that they were given, but they both violated the same law. And so the law refers to the moral law of God. The moral law is exalted all throughout the Old Testament. So he says, we know that whatever the law says is speaking to those who are under the law, and that includes everyone because everyone is condemned by the law, and this is what Paul's been arguing for two chapters. Now, when we come to the statement of verse 19, in order that every mouth may be shut, and this verb shut means to be closed or to stop, the mouth is to be shut, and every man will become silent before God. And so this refers to stopping the mouth from moving and running and saying things. That's the idea of to muzzle, to hush, to be quiet. And, you know, this is something that's difficult for us to do, sometimes just to be quiet. A.T. Robertson says, stopping mouths is a difficult business. Any of us that have kids, when you're trying to explain things to them or discipline them, we know that can be a difficult thing to do. But what may be difficult for me is not difficult for God. God knows how to shut a mouth. All God does is lay His holy law out before us, and all mouths are immediately shut. And not only will the law shut every mouth, it does much more. It will condemn all of mankind. And this term condemn is a legal forensic term. It's a term that means answerable, to be answerable to. And within the context, it means to be answerable to God. It literally means to be under judgment. You are the subject of prosecution. That's the type of arena that Paul's drawn our attention to. It describes one who is under judgment and one who is pronounced guilty. So this is a term that must always be used in a legal setting, and Paul deliberately uses this term to show that we are answerable before God, and this scope is universal, all mankind. And so this makes light, you know, this makes sense in light of what Paul's already said. Go back to verse 9 here in Romans 3. Remember what he says, what then, are we Jews better than they Gentiles? And he says, not at all, for we have previously charged that both Jews and Greeks, that they're all under sin. Everyone is under sin. And so, as a result, they are under the judgment of sin, and since all are under sin, all have, and they continue to break the law of God. You remember what Paul says over here in Romans 4? Look at verse 15. He says, because the law brings about wrath, and where there is no law, there's no transgression. And so, all this goes together, but I wanted you to see that it is everyone that is condemned because all are under the law, and since all have violated God's law, His law condemns them. And you might say, well, not everybody has heard the law of God. But just go back to chapter 2 of Romans. Do you remember what Paul says back over there in verse 12? Paul deals with this. For as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law. As many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law... And what he's talking about there is having the law written in a codified form. These, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the law, the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them, in the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. So what is he saying? Just because these Gentiles don't have the written law doesn't mean they're without excuse, because they do have a law, and it's written on their heart. And we know it's written on their heart. How do we know? Well, if you try to steal from a Gentile who doesn't have the Mosaic law or the moral law written in front of them, what are they going to say to you? If I went around the world and stole from anybody, what are they all universally going to say? Well, you can't. You ought not do that. Now, where does this sense of oughtness come from? It comes from the law of God that's written on their heart. They know. And so that's what he's saying. When you do the things that are of the law, you are a law unto yourself. And in other words, what he's saying is that you know right from wrong. Why? Because it's been written on your heart. You know murder's wrong. You know stealing's wrong. You know cheating on your spouse is wrong. You know bearing false witness is wrong. These things are written on your heart. You know they're wrong. And so even though someone might not have ever read the Ten Commandments, it doesn't let them off the hook because they know the law of God because it's written on their heart. And so this is why they stand condemned. So when I come to Romans 3:19, Paul's point here is that all mankind will stand answerable to God. And so the Gentiles, when they refuse to worship God, and the Jews, when they who have the written law, they reject God's law, it's proof positive that mankind stands condemned before God. And so Paul says, every mouth will be stopped. Every excuse will be extinguished. And here's the reason. Verse 20, Romans 3, verse 20. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, but by the law is the knowledge of sin. And so, because, and this is causal, by the deeds of the law, and this phrase is very similar to what we read in Psalm 143:2, where it says, do not enter into the judgment with your servant, for in your sight no one living is righteous. Paul's alluding to this when he's dealing with this idea, by the deeds of the law, no flesh shall be justified. And the reason why is that no flesh can be justified because all are under sin. They're all under the dominion and power of sin. We're corrupt. We're depraved. And so we can't be justified by the deeds of the law because we're habitual lawbreakers. Okay? And so in verse 20, when he talks about the flesh, he's talking about something that's weak. He's talking about something that's frail. As human beings in the flesh, we are weak. We're so easily swayed towards carnal ends. We have passions. We have desires that do not bring glory to God. And so in our flesh, we are weak and we succumb to those desires. And so Paul says in verse 20 that by the deeds of the law, no flesh shall be justified. And we'll discuss this term in much more detail when we get, you know, or we've talked about this in the past, this idea of being declared righteous, right, in verses 21 through 26. We've looked at that in the past. But this is a legal term. This idea of no flesh will be justified, it's a legal term that does not mean to make righteous, but rather it means to be pronounced righteous. So to be justified means you are legally declared righteous before God. Now that's a very strong statement made by Paul. He's saying here in verse 20, no flesh will be pronounced righteous. And the reason why is that this is the case is because God is just and man is not. And so how can those of us who are under the law ever be justified? And so the moment we sin, we break God's law, I can apologize for it, I can pay retribution, but I'm still guilty. I cannot make the imperfect perfect, but God can. Because what He can do through the work of Christ is transfer my sin to Him and His righteousness to me. So Paul says that by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified, and here's the reason why. Because the law is what? The knowledge of sin. This is experiential knowledge. This is knowledge that I can know from experience. For through the law is the knowledge of sin. And this is why the unregenerate want to pull the law of God out of sight, out of public sight. They don't want to be reminded that they stand condemned before a holy God. But it is the law that drives the sinner to Christ. And what does the church do? Well, they argue it's not right to force our views on society. But that's not our position. The church did not come up with these laws. These are laws that were given to us from God Himself. And so we can hide them, we can store them away, we can put them away, but it's not going to change the reality that on Judgment Day, God's holy law will be the standard that these sinners will be condemned by. Mankind stands condemned because of his sins of commission and omission. He is condemned of both open and public sins, but he's also condemned because of the sins that he does in secret. He is damnable in God's sight, not only because of what he says and does, but even because of what he is when you go back and read Romans 3, 9 through 18. Now, this is a stinging indictment. And the scene here is a courtroom setting. And so the setting is very serious here. The sentence has been read. There is a complete silence here. The defendant is given a chance to say something in his defense, but he has nothing to say. Why? Because he's condemned before this holy, righteous law and his mouth is shut. He is speechless because the evidence is so great against him. And so there's complete silence. This is a scene that is being pictured here. And since God is all-knowing, the evidence that is piled up against us will be overwhelming to the point that our mouths will be shut. And so there's nothing to do but wait for the pronouncement and the execution of the sentence. So this is a courtroom scene and God is sitting there on the bench and we all know that we are spiritually bankrupt. I mean, this is where we are. Without Christ, this is where we are. That's our position. And so you ask, well, is there any way out? Maybe there's some kind of loophole. Maybe there will be some kind of prosecutorial misconduct. Well, you can hope for that, but you'd be sadly mistaken because we're dealing with God. Notice, remember what God, what Paul says in Romans 2:2, but we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. God will always judge according to the truth of the fact. In Romans 2:16, notice what he says here. In the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. Paul tells us that God will even know all your secret thoughts. And so when he judges, he'll have all the facts. This is a sobering passage, no doubt. So Paul says that no one will ever be justified by law works, and the reason why is because the law requires perfect obedience. And we can put up all kind of acts of righteousness, but they fall away when the law is held before us. God's straight edge is held before us. All of our righteous acts are like what? They're like filthy rags. And our mouths will be shut. We're weak. We're helpless. And this is what Paul wants me to understand. He is lawfully using the law. Do you see that? In this latter day ministry, he is teaching us how to use the law correctly. And you know, when you go and you look at this passage, I mean, this is why men like Robert Schuller and them are so wrong. You don't build people up and stroke their egos in order to save them. You show them their true selves as they stand before God's holy law. Paul's setting forth how you begin the gospel. You start the gospel by making one understand what their greatest need is. They stand condemned before this holy God, and as a result, they need to understand how to be righteous with this God. C.S. Lewis said it this way, I didn't go to religion to make me happy. I always had a bottle of port. That would do that. If you want a religion to make you feel comfortable, I certainly do not recommend Christianity. And that's right. Christianity is not about, you know, Christianity has nothing to do with making you feel comfortable in your sin. I think that's a big mistake of a lot of churches. But this is what Paul teaches, and he's getting ready to show us the remedy in verses, you know, if you remember our study of Romans, in Romans 3:21 and following, he shows you the remedy. But I wanted you to see a lawful use of the law. Paul says that we know that whatsoever the law says, it says to them who are under the law. And there's no question, who is under the law of God? We know this. Everyone is under the law of God. Now, there's a real problem within the church today because the church is confused on this issue. The church cannot give a straight answer to who is under the law. Well, I think the answer is sufficiently covered here. Paul says every mouth will be shut, so that the whole world may become guilty before God. It just seems from this text, in the eyes of Paul, all flesh is under the law of God. So I want to spend a little bit of time thinking about this issue of the law of God. Macon, in his book about the law, said this, in his book, What is Faith? He says, a low view of the law always brings legalism in religion. A high view of the law makes a man a seeker after grace. Pray God that a high view may prevail again. Now, Macon was dealing with the liberalism that was taking place in the seminaries back in his day, and around the 1920s. You know, liberalism was a real problem back then. I want to read that again. A low view of the law always brings legalism in religion. A high view of the law makes a man a seeker after grace. Pray God that the high view may prevail again. And what is he saying about saying that the law of God and the principles of morality, they're not contrary to religion of grace, but absolutely necessary. Now, many of us look at the law through the eyes of the Pharisees, and we tend to back off from the law. But let me be clear that the Pharisees had a place, you know, had placed their traditions over the law of God and placed burdens on man rather than using the law lawfully and in using the law in such a way that it would push man to the grace of God by the proper use of the law. And in fact, the Pharisees didn't keep the law is the reason why they had no interest in the Savior. You see, a low view of the law will, by definition, bring in legalism. They had a high view of their traditions, but they had a low view of the law of God, the true law of God. A low view of the law of God will always bring legalism. You see, when you remove God's holy, just standard, which is His law, you by definition will replace it with something that's not holy and just. I mean, look at all the churches around us who deny God's law, either by creed or by practice. They do have a law, however. They do have a standard by which they live. But if it's not God's law, if it's not God's standard, then it's replaced with their own standard, which is not based on the infinite wisdom of God, but on their finite wisdom polluted by the fall. Do you understand that? This is why those who have a low view of God's law will always be legalistic in their views. You understand that? They set their own standard. I mean, everyone lives by a standard. The question is, whose standard are you going to live by? Despite the conventional wisdom of the day, a high view of the law of God shows us our error and our inability to keep it perfectly. And this is what forces us to become seekers after grace. Do you understand that? It is a proper use of God's law that makes us seekers after grace. See, legalism is avoided and grace is promoted only when we have a high view of God's standard, a high view of God's law. And so here's the question for each and every one of us here today. Do we have such a view of God's law? Are we teaching God's law to ourselves and to our children in such a way they must see God's grace in order for them to ever be saved from the consequences of their sin? I want you to think about the fact that we cannot live in a culture, we cannot live in homes, we cannot live in with churches, with one another, with a rule-less Christianity. A church without rules cannot function. Now the question is, whose rules? See, we as believers have been brought into Christ's kingdom. And every kingdom, by definition, has its laws by which the citizens must live. And the kingdom of Christ is no different. Now, it should be obvious that we cannot rule out rules. Therefore, we're confronted with the question, by whose rules are we going to live? Whose absolutes, whose moral ethics are we going to live by? Whose commands are we going to follow? And if the modern church is teaching about the laws of God is correct, in other words, they're not binding, we're under grace, we're not under law, we're not bound by any law, then if we had such a view, then whose rules will we live by? And you see, one of the problems that we have in this land is that if society brings in rules that say promote murder, then if you deny God's law, then by what standard can you say society is wrong? Do you see the problem with some of the fundamentalist churches in this land that says we are not under the law and distort that by saying we're under grace? Now, are they promoting that anything goes? We see we have to have a moral standard by which to live by. And if it's not God's law or God's standard, then whose standard are you going to live by? Now, we can see this and do this what-if scenario with, you know, our church versus other church or whatever. But let's ask the question, let's drive it home. By what standard does your house, is it ruled? Is it ruled by God's holy standard and how to run a house? Or is it your whims? Well, you had a bad night, you didn't get enough sleep, so today you got a whole different standard than you did the day before when you were resting. Can you see how that'd be frustrating? Can you understand how it'd be frustrating to live in a house where the standard's always moving? And I'm not talking about moving the standard because you read God's Word and you said, hey, hang on one second. We're over here. God's Word said I need to be over here. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the standard moves every day because you're moody, because you got a bad temper, or when you don't sleep, you're just not yourself. You know the old Snicker commercial? You know, when you're hungry, you're just not yourself. So if you rule like that, could you see where that would be a frustration to your family, to your children? We all have to live by a set of rules. The question, once again, whose rules? By what standard are we going to live by? Think about what's going on with our land. Let's back up. If God's church is not living by His standard, what do you think it has? How would that reflect itself in society? Right? I mean, in this land, we now condone abortions, divorce for convenience. Sodomy is pretty much practiced openly in this land. Fornication is just accepted, and it's accepted just in churches. And this is what happens when a society when the church has a low view of God's law. You see, when we remove God's law as the standard, it's going to be replaced. And it's going to be replaced with man's philosophy, man's law, from his fallen state with his finite wisdom. And I think this is one of the biggest failures of the church. The church in this country has refused to hold the divine law as a standard for morality within this land. And what's replaced God's standard is man's fallen view of morality. And just so we're clear on this, this is what happens within our home, this is what will happen in this church if we look to any other standard than God's law. Now think about the impediment this is to the gospel. When we remove God's law, we remove the context for the good news. Do you understand that? Greg Bonson used to contrast morality with legality. And he reasoned that it's possible, and we do see this in our day, to vote immoral laws into practice. So the question is, what should be the basis for morality? Immanuel Kant said that we should look to man's reason in order to determine what rules to follow. And Kant came up with this, what he called the categorical imperative. He argued that if mankind were logical and reasonable, they could figure out what rules to follow. And this is the pathway I think our society and our culture has followed. And unfortunately, this is the pathway many within the church have followed. And, you know, if you guys haven't thought about this, if you haven't really tried to bring your home under the dominion of Christ in every area, maybe you've gone down this pathway as well. But let's be clear. Paul does not say we're under man's reason and that it's man's reason that shuts every mouth and condemns everyone. He says it is God's law that does this. And so the standard by which we will be judged, the standard that was violated by man and made us rebels before God, is His holy law. Christ did not come to redeem us from man's reasoning, but from the curse of the law. And we can deny it, we can dismiss it, we can allow our loved ones to continue to violate it while we stand by silently, but God's law will be the standard by which mankind is judged. And as for believers, when God says, "Be holy, for I'm holy," do you think He's referring to man's reasoning? No, He's looking, when He talks about you being holy because He's holy, He's looking to His moral standard. And so when we see the judgment of God upon this land is because this land is violated, not man's reasoning, not man's logic, not man's faulty law. It's because when we look at the curses of God that comes upon us and the judgment that comes upon us or comes upon any land, it's because they deny and they reject and they rebel against His holy law. And so my question for us, are you content with human reasoning and logic as the standard, not just in this land, but to guide your own life? I mean, look at the caliber of men that have been placed in positions of authority in this land. Are you content with following their reason and the logic and the standard? And I would hope not. I hope the answer is no. But this is what we've done. Instead of placing our trust and submitting, you know, and bowing our knee to the law of the Omniscient One, the One who, when Isaiah saw Him and was surrounded by this host of angelic beings who cried out, "Holy, holy, holy," we refuse to study His law and to learn how to apply it and to teach it. We're somehow, it just seems to me, the church seems to be embarrassed because we think that it's too harsh or that it's unjust. But if that is how we think, then we only demonstrate how fallen we are. God's law is not harsh or unjust ever. Take that out of your thinking, out of your vocabulary. God's law reflects His character. God's law is never too harsh. God's law is never unjust. Do you understand that God has never once made an apology for His law that He's given us? Christ never once, standing there before the Jews, says, "You know, my dad, my father, for the most part, he got 90% right. But there's 10% I think he was a little hard." Never once. Christ never apologized for the judgments that God the Father poured out on the nation of Israel for their rebellion against His law. Christ never makes apology for the Father. Why? There's nothing to apologize for, because everything He does is holy, just, and good. Don't let the wisdom of this age distort your thinking about God's law. If you're convinced that God's law is too harsh, the problem is with you, and you just don't understand it. Okay? So the question is, what law should we follow? We should follow God's law and none other. Now let me stop here, because next time I'm going to pick up with this lawful use of the law. And I'm going to talk about the necessity of God's law. It is absolutely necessary. Okay? But can you see that there's no way any society, any home, any church can live without rules? There's no such thing. In other words, if you've read about in history where you see a lawless culture, you understand the idea of not being under God's law is not freedom, it's lawlessness. Have you ever read about the French Rebellion, you know, their revolution? Is that what you want? I mean, that's a pretty brutal place when you study out in history. So let's do away with these thoughts that we can be a lawless society. You're going to live by somebody's law. The question is, do we live by God's holy, just, and good law? Or are we going to live by man's fallen reasoning and with his finite knowledge? Let him try to govern apart from God's moral standard, okay? So we'll stop here, and Lord willing, we'll pick up next week and look at the necessity of God's law. And remember, this is all in the context of the latter-day ministry. We're in the latter-day ministry. We're not to be out there teaching a gospel according to Robert Schuller. We're to be teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, the same gospel that Paul preached. And before Paul got to the good news, he laid out the condemned state of all mankind because they have violated God's holy law.